On this episode of Skeptico, cardiologist and renowned NDE researcher, Dr. Pim van Lommel.
I think the gap is not that big as you presume. I think the skeptics are very active, and the skeptics have their own truth, and they don't listen to somebody else who has a different opinion. So there's a gap, and there will always be a gap. There is no discussion possible with skeptics because they have the truth. But a lot of physicians are a little bit more open, but they won't write articles. They won't write or tell about it in public. I know some physicians who had a near-death experience. They said to me and wrote to me that what happened to me now, I've always said this is impossible. Now it happened to me.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris. And before we get started with today's interview with Dr. Pim van Lommel, I want to take a couple of minutes and talk about skepticism and a couple of things that have come up in the Skeptico forums. Before Skeptico, I don't think I ever had more than a couple of forum posts in my whole life. And since I've already passed the 1,000 mark in forum posts on Skeptico, you can see that I've changed quite a bit. And this dialogue that I've been able to have with Skeptico listeners has been very informative for me. And it's also shaped a lot of the shows and a lot of the directions we've taken with many of our guests. The other thing I feel like I've gotten from the Skeptico forums is a deeper appreciation for the skeptical position, if you will. Not that I agree with all the skeptics I dialogue with there, because in general I don't, but I've gained an appreciation for what I've dubbed as the two skeptical questions. And they both relate to this interview we have coming up with Pim van Lommel, but they're also broader in scope as well. So the first skeptical question that seems to always crop up is the rebuttal question, the but question. And it's obvious. It's what's the other side have to say? And while all of us who are scientifically and reason logic-based ask those questions all the time, there's something unique in the way that the question gets framed within this skeptic versus believer context. And the difference is the depth of rebuttal. So let me give you an example of how this has played out in the Skeptico forum, and then you'll understand what I mean. Recently in the Skeptico forum, I posted an article by Chris Carter. Chris Carter is a fairly well-known author in these circles. His first book was titled Parapsychology and the Skeptics. And I should mention, he has a second book out as well on near-death experiences, and we're going to have Chris on shortly to talk about that. But anyway, in this article that Chris authored, he gave a thorough and quite convincing response to Richard Wiseman's article on Heads I Win, Tails You Lose, A Critique of Parapsychology. And we've had Wiseman on with Rupert Sheldrick to debate that in the past, but Chris's article kind of goes one step further and lays out in a very detailed form some of the arguments against Wiseman's claims. Well, when I posted this on the Skeptico forum, I got quite a reaction. As a matter of fact, the reaction was so strong that one of the posters essentially dared me to repost some of the issues in the James Randi Educational Foundation, the JRE forum. So now if you're not familiar with the forum world and the skeptic versus believer world, the JRE forum is heavy-duty, hardcore skeptics. And it's a group that certainly pulls no punches when it comes to flaming ideas or people who don't fit into the way they see things. Now, in fairness to the folks over in the JRE forum, there's a lot of very smart people over there, and there's a number of people that post there in the JRE forum as well as in the Skeptico forum, although a few less than there were before this last few weeks, which is another story. But back to this story. So I reposted this article by Chris Carter and his critique of Richard Wiseman. I posted that over in the James Randi Educational Foundation forum. And the response that I got to that is what I really wanted to talk about, because it gave me an insight, an appreciation for what skeptics had to deal with. In the article, Chris laid out a lot of well-known issues that have been pretty well hashed out between parapsychology researchers and parapsychology critics. But when I looked at the number of posts and the quality of posts, which were really pretty good in the JRE forum, I got an appreciation for just how hard it would be for anyone to sort out this information. One of the points that was raised was the whole issue of Wiseman and Sheldrick's experiment with the psychic dog, the JT experiment, which if you don't know about it, go back and look in the previous episodes of Skeptico because we've only done about 10 hours a show on it. But that case is about as a clear-cut example as you can get of skeptical misdeeds, in this case on the part of Richard Wiseman, who, in the words of Rupert Sheldrick's, persistence in this deception is hard to fathom. And it really is. If you really understand the case and you really pull it apart, there's really no way to defend Richard Wiseman. And even a lot of the posters on the JREF forum were kind of carefully tiptoeing around like, hey, let's not get too close to that one because we know it doesn't have any solid ground. But you really couldn't have gotten that out of the forum. So my point is, if you were a skeptic and you heard me say, hey, Sheldrick's evidence of telepathy among dogs is pretty convincing, and then you went over and looked at the other side, the butt side, the rebuttal side, and you tried to sort out what they had to say, I got to say, I don't know how you could do it. Not so much because it's intellectually heavy-duty challenging. It's not. But it takes a good deal of time and persistence to pull it all apart. And most of us don't have the time to deal with it, especially on every little minor issue that comes up. So what do? Well, we wind up putting our trust in people we believe have looked at it and have given it a fair evaluation. And while that's convenient and useful, it's also part of the problem. I mean, if Skeptico has shown me anything, and hopefully it's shown you this same thing, you gotta do your own research. You gotta figure this stuff out on your own. And if you're trusting someone else for the answer to these kind of questions, you're always going to have that nagging doubt in your mind if they're really telling you the truth. So the first issue for skeptics is the but question. And it's a hard one to overcome because there's just too much information out there. And a lot of the skeptical stuff sounds just as good at first glance as the believer stuff. So I don't know that there's an easy answer for that, but I guess I have a little bit of a deeper appreciation of just how hard it is to sort through all this stuff. And I guess that challenge leads right into the second skeptical question, but it does so in a strange, very counterintuitive kind of way. Because the second skeptical question, as I see it, is the if question. And the if question takes a couple of forms. The first if question has to do with authority. It goes something like, if this is true, if consciousness survives death, if ESP is true, if mediums really can talk to the dead, then why doesn't everybody know it? Why hasn't science embraced it? Why haven't all these people I trust embraced this information if it's so compelling, if the proof is that strong? And of course, that's a question we've talked quite a bit about on this show, and it's really harder to unravel than it might seem, and it leads us into all sorts of other areas of social pressures and academic institutions and paradigm shifts and all those other things that we'll leave aside for a minute, but just to acknowledge that first if question is there. But the second if question, I think, is really the one that winds up tripping up most people. And that's the if question that says, if this is true, then what else is true? If this is true, then what other beliefs do I have that have to start being re-examined? And in this regard, I think a lot of parapsychology or psi or consciousness researchers, I think they can do themselves a real disservice if they undersell the importance of this if question. I mean, if you're researching telepathy and you say telepathy is real and I've proven it in the lab, and if you don't at the same time acknowledge that change in paradigm that telepathy implies changes everything in science, fundamentally, every area of science you can imagine it touches on. If you don't acknowledge that, then I think you leave a lingering doubt in the minds of people who are skeptical. Because you know what? That's one thing the skeptics have figured out. They understand the slippery slope, if you will. They understand that if our mind isn't a product 100% of our brain, if consciousness is separate from brain function, then survival of consciousness is not just on the table, but given the data we already have, it's a fait accompli. I mean, the data's just too strong for that. And then if you jump onto that stone and you say, okay, consciousness is separate from brain function, and therefore maybe consciousness does survive death, well, then you're right there knocking on the gates of heaven, if you will, because you have to bring into the conversation the content of those experiences that says there is a higher order, there is some universal feeling of love, of consciousness, the core culture war issues that have been battled for hundreds of years. Hey, those are on the table. So don't do your telepathy experiment and pretend that you can still play in a little atheistic sandbox over here, because you can't. Once you start going down these series of if questions, it gets really scary, really quick. And at the end of the day, I think that's what trips up a lot of people who are skeptical. At some level, maybe a level that they're not fully aware of, they've thought through the if-then implications of opening themselves up to this information, to changing their belief systems to accommodate some of this data. And it's scary, because most of us are pretty comfortable with the way that our world is, or at least we're comfortable enough that we don't want to turn it upside down and shake it radically. And yet, that's what paradigm shifting is all about. So on today's show, I have an interview with NDE researcher Dr. Pin Van Lommel, who has an interesting perspective on these issues we've been talking about for a couple of reasons. One is because he's confronted them head on. As a traditionally trained and well-respected cardiologist, his research has caused him to step outside of the belief system that was infused in his training and among his colleagues and find a different truth. And the other way I think it's relevant is the personal transformation that this information took him through. We only touch on that on a little bit in the interview, but it really is, I think, my favorite part of this dialogue with Dr. Van Lommel, because hopefully most of us aren't going to face a near-death experience. But the idea that maybe we can study, research, use logic, and come to some of the same conclusions that people who have had these fantastic experiences come to the same conclusions they do is hopeful for all of us. So please stay with me for this very interesting interview with Dr. Pin Van Lommel. Today's guest is a world-class cardiologist and one of the leading medical experts on near-death experiences. His book, titled Consciousness Beyond Life, The Science of Near-Death Experience, covers his more than 25 years researching NDEs in the Netherlands and around the world. Dr. Pin Van Lommel, thanks so much for joining me today on Skeptico.
Okay, you're welcome.
So, Dr. Van Lommel, as your book details, you've been studying near-death experience for quite some time. Why this book right now?
We started a study in 1988 in the Netherlands, a prospective study in a total of 344 patients who survived cardiac arrest, to study if you could understand how it is possible that patients can experience an enhanced consciousness during cardiac arrest, because according to our current medical concept, it's not possible to experience consciousness during a cardiac arrest when circulation and breathing have ceased. So we studied this for quite a long time, and then we also did a longitudinal study with interviews after 2 and 8 years. So this total study took 10 years, and it was published in The Lancet in 2001. And following this publication, there were so many questions again, and I was lecturing so many times around the world that a lot of people asked me about the book. And then I just started to write it in the Netherlands. It was published about 3 years ago, and it was translated into German and now to English.
Right. And the book's been very successful in Europe. I understand it's sold well over 100,000 copies, actually around the world. So we're kind of a little bit slower here in the States to get it published here. But it, as you just mentioned, it has been out for a little while, huh?
Yes. It was in Holland. It was a bestseller. So it was sold 100,000 copies within 1 year, and it was even nominated for the best book of the year 2008, which is quite exciting because the subject of the book is not that easy.
Right, right. Well, and that's certainly encouraging. And I want to get into that in a minute about what is really the state of our culture versus our medical establishment vis-a-vis this research. But the first thing I wanted to jump into is one thing I found interesting in the book is your account of the personal transformation that you went through being exposed to this information and you know, coming from maybe a little bit about your background, which was very traditional in terms of what we'd expect for a scientist, a physician, and also being very much of a materialist and believing that, hey, this is it. When you die, you die. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Yes. Well, I was raised and also during a study of medicine in Utrecht years and years ago. It was just, I accepted everything that was just, there was one kind of science, and that was materialistic science. And I just accepted also the fact that everybody thought that consciousness was a product of a functioning brain. And it was because I was, in 86, after reading the book by George Ritchie, Return from Tomorrow, about the near-death experience he experienced as a medical student in 1943, I was so curious that I had only heard it once before in 69, that you started to ask my patients who survived the cardiac arrest if they could remember something of the period of unconsciousness. And then, to my big surprise, within 2 years, out of 50 patients I asked, 12 of them told me about their NDE. So, and that was for me the start point, because it was just the scientific curiosity, how it could be explained that people can have an enhanced consciousness when they are unconscious, when the heart doesn't work, when there is no breathing, or when the brain stops functioning. And that's the reason we started the study. And that's also when I had so many patients telling me about his enhanced consciousness, also with the possibility of perception out and above the body, that I had to change all my concepts.
What was that like for you, that personal transformation? Okay, because as a physician, and you break it down, hey, I can understand that. You know, you're curious, people are telling you this. But from a personal level, what did that do? Those are really shaking up some fundamental beliefs for you.
I think when you have spoken to patients who had a near-death experience, with their emotions, when they're just reluctance to share their experience with you, and they're so honest, and they're so overwhelmed by this experience as well, that you just believe them, because they're so honest. And then you talk to one or two, but I talk to hundreds of those patients, and now just you get convinced that there is more than what we can see, what we can measure. And that is really the problem in materialistic science. You can measure just the material aspects of the brain, but you cannot measure consciousness. You cannot measure the content of consciousness. You cannot measure what you feel or what you think. So that was a challenge for me as well.
Yeah, let me push that a little bit further, because I think what I'm getting at is, and what this show, Skeptico, has been about, is that I think the knowledge, the information itself, without having the experience, can be deeply transformational. I mean, if you come to grips or begin to come to grips with the fact that science is revealing that maybe what the great wisdom traditions throughout time have taught us, that we're more than our bodies, that we may be something called spirit. I mean, that has to give you pause for most people who grew up in our modern society, atheistic as it is. Can the information, have you seen it in yourself, that the information itself, beyond the experience, is personally transforming to people?
Oh, yes. And also for me it was transforming, because you realize it, and I think it's a kind of resonating within your inner knowledge, inner knowing, that what they tell is the truth.
Yeah.
And there is no, let's say, the death is just the physical end of the person, but not the end of the essence of who you are. And there's a continuity of consciousness. And that's really mind-blowing as well. but you can accept it. And especially, I was so amazed when I was started reading about it, that in all world religions, in all times, in all cultures, this has been said and written down as well.
Which makes it all the more interesting, going back to what you describe as a natural medical curiosity. The question that pops into mind is, why don't more doctors have that kind of curiosity, or maybe the courage to explore that curiosity? And, you know, one of the stories you relate in the book that I think relates to this is a cardiologist who, I think this, you can tell the story better than I can, but was at a conference and stood up and said, "Hey, this is all bunk. I've been in this, I've been a cardiologist for 20 years. My patients have never told me any stories like this," right?
Yeah, that's a wonderful story. So there was a conference about near death experience in a university hospital with more than 300 people in attendance. And there were some lectures about NDEs. There were some people talking about the NDEs. And then cardiologists stood up and said, "Well, I'm a cardiologist for more than 25 years. I've never heard such absurd stories. This is total nonsense. I don't believe one word of it." And then another person stood up in the audience and said, "Well, I am one of your patients. And I have had a near-death experience. And you should be the last one I would ever tell." And that's how it works, because they feel that it is impossible to share their experience with those physicians who are not open for it.
And maybe that's a lot to expect. Maybe it's too much to expect. You know, one of the things I want to chat with you about, I sent you a clip from a recent interview I did with Dr. Sam Parnia, who, of course, works in the UK, the AWARE project, which is investigating near-death experience. Here's a guy who studied NDEs for 10 years, and is still, you know, he's torn. You can tell he's torn, but he is still clinging to this. These are probably just an illusion. These are probably just a quirk of the brain. Can I play this clip for you again and then see if we can talk about it a little bit?
Yes, of course you can.
And so if we get, say, 500 people who all supposedly die and come back and all that sort of stuff, and they all claim they saw Dr. Smith and they have all these incredible stories and they can describe what was happening, then supposedly, if they really are out of body, they should see that picture. If, on the other hand, it's just an illusion, it's a trick of the mind, which it may well be, and I suspect it will turn out to be, then we would expect no one to be able to see those pictures.
Okay, so, you know, I'm not going to go into the details of the experiment, which is kind of interesting to me in the way that it's framed up. But here's a guy who says, "Hey, I suspect, my hunch is this is all an illusion." What are your thoughts?
It's not an illusion at all for me. Let's say, when you go to the definition of an illusion, it is a misapprehensive of misleading image. And an out-of-body experience where they have a theoretical perception of what's happening to their body during resuscitation, during operation. And these aspects can be corroborated by doctors and nurses and family members. And it's important because it can not only tell us what they perceive, but also the moment that it happened can be corroborated. And that means that what they perceived from a position out and above their body really happened at a time that they were unconscious, where there was no cardiac function, there was no brain function at all. And because we also know that the brain electrical activity stops after an average of about 15 seconds. So they have an enhanced consciousness, but the possibility of perception out and above the body during a period of a non-functioning brain. And it's also interesting to mention that recently there was a study done by Jan Holden in the book, The Handbook of Near-Death Experiences, where she had a review of 93 corroborated reports with out-of-body experience. And she has found that 92% was completely accurate, and 6 to 10% contained some error, and only 1 to 2% was completely erroneous. So that proves that an NDE cannot be an illusion, nor can it be an hallucination, which is a meaning and experience and perception that has no basis in reality, like in psychosis. And neither is it an delusion, which is an incorrect assessment of a correct perception. So what they perceive really happened. So that can, by definition, be no illusion at all.
So what do you think's going on for a guy like Dr. Parnia? Because, you know, in his in his presentation, he kind of gives these mixed messages. I mean, he's very respectful of these accounts, and he tells these personal accounts that he's had from patients. You know, he tells this account of this three-year-old boy who saw his body above his ambulance and says, hey, there's no way this kid was making this up, or there's no way that there was a cultural influence. And yet, it seems, and I don't want to stretch too far because I interviewed the guy, but I can't reach into his mind. How strong is the pressure to not believe, to not even consider that consciousness might exist outside the brain?
Well, I think I would like to call it a willful ignorance if people don't want to study it. But Samparni is studying it because he's open. But the challenge is for his aware study, will there be one patient who will perceive a hidden sign? And I am afraid there will be no patient at all. Because when we perceive, also now during our life, it's all depending on our intention and attention. So when you walk a whole day in nature with two persons and they ask to write them down what happened to them, you find two total different stories. Or when you drive a car, you don't really perceive what's going on outside you. So you need intention and attention. And when you are out of your body during cardiac arrest, you just see your body or you think of your family will be there, but you will not start looking around if there will be some hidden sign. It's what you called in science the inattentional blindness. If you're not attention, you won't see things.
But what does all that say for the future of this research, in that it seems like we're really at a crossroads to break through that medical establishment, the scientific establishment that is really, really determined to resist any notion of this survival of consciousness? Is there really any chance that we can break through that? Or are we going to wind up with stuff like the AWARE study, which I have to tell you later on in the interview, I think he kind of admits that this is really, it doesn't have much of a chance for really achieving a positive result that would convince anybody.
But the positive result is when you are trying to find patients who will see a hidden sign is perhaps not what you want to what you can find. When you have patients with a veridical perception during out-of-body experience, you have to corroborate these veridical perceptions. You need doctors and nurses and family members, when you hear such a story, you have to try to find out if what they tell is true. And the skeptics always say, well, just an anecdote. But there have been so many, many anecdotes. I have heard so many patients talk about details of the resuscitation, which is totally impossible to know. Also, the study of Mar from Sabin from years ago found that patients who had an out-of-body experience could talk about details of resuscitation, which was impossible to know. And it's also interesting to know that one patient of Penisatori, he's an English intensive care nurse who's also performing research in NDE, she had one patient who had an out-of-body experience and who could tell exactly a lot of details about the resuscitation, but he did not see the hidden sign she had put somewhere in the room. So they had no intention, attention to look around. So I think the veridical perception can be corroborated, the better.
Right.
The more, the better. And that's the way we have to study it.
Right. Well, here's what I'm getting at. And I guess it relates back to your book and the success of your book. How do we bridge the gap between the public interest, which is enormous, and the public...
You're right.
And the public acceptance, because, and this is one of those things where, you know, you just lay out the case for people and you lay out the case histories and people go, wow, I guess I have to accept that. And a lot of people are probably already predisposed to think that this might be possible. And yet we jump over into this other world, which is the medical establishment world. And there's this complete denial and this misreporting. I mean, you can personally attest to this. I mean, when your study came out and Michael Shermer famously writes up an interpretation of your research, which is exactly the opposite of what you said. And yet There's never any retraction. There's never any full do-over. There seems to be this huge gap between the public and the medical establishment. And are we ever going to bridge that gap?
I think the gap is not that large, that big as you presume. I think the skeptics are very active, and the skeptics have their own truth, and they don't listen to somebody else who has a different opinion. So there's a gap, and there will always be a gap. There is no discussion possible with skeptics because they have the truth. But a lot of physicians are a little bit more open, but they won't write articles. They won't write or tell about it in public. I know some physicians who had a near-death experience. They said to me and wrote to me that what happened to me now, I've always said this is impossible. Now it happened to me. There are 9 million people in the U.S. who had a near-death experience, and there are even more people who had a post-mortal experience or after-death communication. And all those people had an experience in their consciousness, which doesn't fit in the current material science, but it's true for them. And they are so happy to read papers or books that is for them supporting the experience they had. And most physicians don't believe or not are open for it. But I think it's changing. I'm positive. I'm now invited for lectures in universities, for physicians, for hospitals, etc. So in the Netherlands, it's changing. But it is a slow change. And especially scientists who are not religious, who don't believe in a kind of what they call an afterlife, are not open for this kind of discussions. But the general public and even physicians are more open to it than the, let's say, the 200 scientists who are just the leading scientists in the United States.
So,
and they are people who are editors of journals. They are the people who are in universities and high positions.
Right.
So the Academy of Science in the United States, those people, only 7% are religious. And the general population, it's about 90%.
Well, I think one of the challenges is to decouple near-death experience science from any particular religious interpretation or even any religious interpretation at all. It seems like the first step is just jumping across this chasm of consciousness. So maybe tell us about how this research into near-death experience has further informed and driven your general interest in consciousness research.
Well, it's especially the interest in the relationship between consciousness and the function of the brain, because as I had learned always and accepted the hypothesis, the never proven hypothesis, that consciousness is a product of the brain, then this hypothesis should be discussed again, because people experience an enhanced consciousness, the paradoxical occurrence of an enhanced consciousness during a period of a non-functioning brain. So I've been sitting also in the literature about what we know about what happens in the brain when the heart stops. And we know that, but we know also the clinical features of such a patient. He loses consciousness within seconds. All his body reflexes are gone, which is a product of the cortex of the brain. But also the brainstem reflexes are gone. The GAG reflex or the corneal reflex or the wide pupils are clinical findings of those patients. And also the breathing stops, so the breathing center close to the brainstem stops functioning. So the clinical findings are that there is no function of the brain anymore, and the electrical activity, when you measure it in the EEG, you see in an average of 15 seconds, there is a flat line. And the average period you need in a coronary care unit to resuscitate the patient is at least 1 to 2 minutes or more. So those all those patients who have a cardiac arrest also in the hospital, let alone an out-of-hospital arrest, must have had a flatline EEG, and they have, about 20%, had a near-death experience, which is an enhanced consciousness with cognition, with emotions, with memories from early childhood, also sometimes with future events, with the meaning of deceased relatives, and also with the end of the experience is the consciousness return into the body. So all these aspects of consciousness that people tell you, and there are so many who have told me or written me, is not possible with the current medical concepts that the brain makes the consciousness, that the consciousness is a product of the brain. This is impossible. So the brain function, for me, it's not producing consciousness, but it is facilitating. That means that it makes it most possible to experience your waking consciousness. It doesn't produce it.
One of the terms you kept using over and over again, I think is key, is this idea of an enhanced consciousness. And for me, that's one of the things that I really don't understand from the folks who are familiar a little bit with the research, and yet they gloss over this. I mean, we're not talking about even the same level of consciousness. We're talking about almost uniformly people reporting an enhanced, a hyper, a super consciousness at a time when, at the very least, the brain is severely compromised, if not completely offline. And I just don't understand how there can just be a complete denial of this basic fact.
Because it doesn't fit in their concepts. They have to change their own paradigm if they accept it. So they close the door. And this enhanced consciousness, what I also call the non-local consciousness, there is no time and no distance. Everything is there at the same time. And you have a life review during cardiac arrest of 2 minutes. You can talk for days about what happened to you, but everything is there at the same time. Mm-hmm. And there's the past and the future there as well. So it's your consciousness in a dimension where there's no time and no space, which is totally different from the consciousness we have here. They are united. So in this physical world, you have the subject and the object. But in the other dimension, there is only subject. You're one with everything.
So, Dr. Van Lommel, what's next for you?
What's next for me? What next for me is, well, by publishing the book, and it will be translated also in French language and also other languages, I hope that a lot of people read it and talk about it with a physician or with a psychologist. A lot of what happened here in Holland, that patients come with my book to the physician, mm-hmm. said, well, read this, and then you understand what happened to me. And now already I have had letters and emails from patients who said, my doctor said, when I tried to talk, just you have to read the book of Van Lommel. Mm-hmm. So it's a help for supporting for people who had this kind of experiences. It's so hard to accept it yourself because it's beyond imagination what happens to you, and you cannot, accept it in this materialistic, capitalistic world. It's a totally different approach for life and death.
Well, it's wonderful to think that book is making that kind of impact and having that kind of effect not only on the public, but also on the medical community. It's neat to see that the doctors are actually then circling back around and saying, I found this to be helpful for my other patients. So even if I'm not totally on board with it, I'm going to recommend it to some other patients.
Yeah, and I will be lecturer in Yale University, for instance. I got an invitation for Yale. Well, that's wonderful. I love to lecture in universities also in Holland, and I've done it also in Germany. And it's good to start to talk about it. And when people hear really what's all about, they have to start thinking about it. They cannot deny it anymore.
Well, it's certainly been great sharing this time with you today, and thanks so much for the book and for your thoughts this morning. Thank you.
You're welcome. And I hear you're open for it, and you have been interested in it, and you have been reading a lot about it, and I like it. So thank you very much for attention as well.
Thanks again to Dr. Pim Van Lommel for joining me today on Skeptico. If you'd like more information on the show, please visit the Skeptico website at skeptiko.com. You'll find links to all our previous shows, an email, Facebook link to me, link to the forums I was talking about, where you can engage with other Skeptico listeners. And as a final note, thanks to all of you who had some very nice emails and comments regarding the last couple episodes of Skeptico. I really appreciate that. So please stay with me. Tell your friends about Skeptico. I have several interesting interviews coming up in the near future, including the interview I mentioned with Chris Carter and several other ones. So that's going to do it for today. Until next time, bye for now.